evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, September 17, 2024. An economist says South Sudan's Minister of Finance has no plans to fix the country's economic crisis.
Politically, yes. You know, he's a politician, he can claim anything that sounds positive. So his statement, I read it, most of it is political statement. There is no economic principle or anything of that sort you can refer to.
And adult education is gaining traction in South Sudan's capital, Juba.
La gente en Agda debe ver dana de mapa madresa.
In the village I was, there was no school. Although I am too old to start school again, I have decided to start learning here because I see education as the only way out by current situation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. An advisor to the economic cluster has criticized the Ministry of Finance for sending political statements to South Sudanese who are looking for solutions to the country's economic crisis. The Minister of Finance said Monday his office is working to improve the economy by using several measures, including the resumption of crude oil export through Sudan. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
South Sudanese are struggling with serious economic challenges, mainly due to hyperinflation. Finance Minister Marial Dongrin Ater yesterday outlined steps aimed at addressing the country's poor economic performance.
These measures are aimed at improving tax revenue mobilization, enhancing crude oil export, securing funding, digitalization and financial inclusion, and fostering food security.
Abraham Alit Mamer, an economist and advisor to the country's economic cluster, called the minister solutions political maneuvering.
You know, economic measures or economic principle or in economic work, it will take some time for it to cushion. When you do things in economics, you incubate them. When you are incubating them, it will take time to grow. So somebody better in the office for 2 months would have less to do what is really happening now. So that is from the economic perspective. But politically, yes, you know, he's a politician, he can claim anything that sounds positive. So his statement, I read it, most of it is political statement. There is no economic principle or anything of that sort you can refer to.
South Sudan depends on oil for its GDP. However, the conflict in Sudan disrupted oil flow, causing major economic hardships in both countries. Dongrin says President Salva Kiir and Sudan's military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, met on Monday to discuss the resumption of South Sudan's oil production.
On the resumption of Dar blend in terms of production and export, we received the President of Sudan, General Burhan, and one of the issues discussed by our president with him is the issue of the resumption of the Dar blend. And as I mentioned, there has been a breakthrough and it will come to public very soon.
In March, the Sudanese government announced the suspension of South Sudan's oil exports through Sudanese territories because of a fault in the pipelines. Mamer cautions South Sudanese against counting on the newly introduced measures to turn things around until the oil starts flowing.
It is not the first time it is being said. It has been said a number of times. Every minister of finance, minister of petroleum, anybody in the government will say that when our delegation went to Port Sudan and they met and they were talking about this thing. So in terms of politics, yes, you can say that.
Proceeds from oil account for about 90% of the South Sudan's revenue. South Sudan has been sending about 150,000 barrels of crude oil per day through Sudan for export since 2011. As of September 16th, 2024, the price of West Texas Intermediate, WTI, crude oil was 70.50 per barrel. The price of Brent crude oil was $72.61 per barrel on September 17th, 2024. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Still in Juba, some South Sudanese say it is not too late to enroll in school, and many who did not get an opportunity to go to school when they were young are now enrolling in adult education to gain some knowledge. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
25-year-old Simon Jala has enrolled in the Knowledge Institute in Juba. He says he needs some reading and writing skills to survive in the South Sudan capital.
In the village I was, there was no school. Although I am too old to start school again, I have decided to start learning here because I see education as the only way out by current situation. If I get a job, I can present my papers, I can make business or anything. That's why I have come to learn here.
A 2022 study by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, found out that over 70% of adults in South Sudan cannot read or write. Rebecca Ding, who is 41 years old, says an accelerated learning program in Juba helped her to learn how to read and write.
Because of education, I make my business, I open my shop. The benefit of my education business is to putting me to know my thing, like I went to account my money. Today I know the price of today, and I know what is happening to my business. And then job is still on me up to now. That one I can pay my brother in University School of Juba.
Michael Thiong, director of a Center for the English Course, an accelerated learning program in Juba, says many people who return to school as adults drop out because of financial challenges and family responsibilities.
It challenges them to start learning the letters, learning the numbers. It is very difficult for them. And they also have family problems, so they are not frequently attending the classes. So that one, it is a challenge. So they don't attend classes regularly, and they don't have also finance to finance their education. What they have in mind is to finance the education for their children.
Awud Deng Achwil, the Minister for General Education, says education is free in South Sudan and that parents have no excuse for not taking their children to school.
The Transitional Constitution of the Republic of South Sudan, 2011, as amended 2013, enshrined the right to education for every citizen. Article 29.2 says, all level of government shall promote education at all level and shall ensure free and compulsory education at the primary level and secondary level. They shall also provide free illiteracy eradication programs.
She says her ministry is expected to integrate information communications technology into the curriculum to help students prepare for the job market after completing their studies. The World Population Review, an independent company that prepares up-to-date global population data, ranks South Sudan as the country with the third lowest literacy rate in its latest research. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayor in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Darfur, where the French medical charity known as MSF says the situation at Zamzam camp in North Darfur is dire. MSF's chief executive officer, Avril Binyat, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that after conducting nutrition screenings at the camp, humanitarian organizations should deliver food and other emergency supplies into Zamzam.
Airdrops are never the ideal situation. You've got all kinds of risk of whatever is dropped, if it's food, not necessarily reaching those who are most acutely in need. There is always a risk of people on the ground not managing it properly. Anything can happen. It can be very unpredictable. At this point, though, the catastrophic situation is so horrific that we have to do something to work around what are absolutely impenetrable, it seems, barriers to being able to bring in the aid necessary, particularly the therapeutic foods that we need to be able to treat all these thousands of malnourished children. We have more than 29,000 children under 5 years old screened last week during a vaccination campaign in the camp, in Zamzam camp near El Fasher, that were suffering from severe acute malnutrition. I mean, the numbers are off the charts. It's well beyond any threshold that we have seen thus far in Sudan.
How do you even stop the RSF from grabbing those supplies once they drop and fall on the ground? If they're, you know, taking charge so much and intimidating people that are still there, how do you stop that from happening?
Well, obviously, it all is going to have to rely upon a lot of negotiation. A lot of people on the ground can be trusted, including colleagues of Doctors Without Borders, other aid workers that are going to do their best with the situation at hand. We have to negotiate for whatever is dropping in proximity or into the camp, on top of the camp, to be able to be managed in an appropriate way.
In the Zem camp, are people already dying there, children, other vulnerable people?
Yes, without a doubt. And, you know, the mass screenings that we've done would certainly indicate that many, many more will die. We are critically low on therapeutic foods to treat the malnourished children. There's no time to waste. These are preventable deaths to be avoided. And much as we've seen in other parts of the country, when you have warring parties that are just not facilitating the humanitarian aid coming through, who are creating all kinds of barriers, whether it's RSF or the SAF around Khartoum, we are seeing that the urgent needs that people have are not being met.
This is one of the most expensive ways to try to reach people. Do you have the funding to do this?
Well, the funding, I think, is there. The ability to really scale up commensurate with the needs is not because of these impediments. And if it's not security impediments in terms of the risks that aid agencies have to calculate, whether it makes sense to continue programming, if it's not actual direct threats of being caught up in fighting or in the wrong place at the wrong time, we have tremendous administrative barriers in Sudan from the RSF, the SAF, the government. It's been very, very difficult, even with aid organizations, the UN and donor governments, willing to pledge to do more for Sudan. We are, as Doctors Without Borders or MSF, one of the only organizations that has maintained a presence around the country. But there are certain places like Al Fashir where we just have not been able to because of all the fighting that was going on. We had to suspend our activities there and very much look forward to resuming those activities.
That's Avril Binyat, MSF's chief executive officer. She spoke to my colleague Carol Van Damme. More than 400 million children the world over are not getting nutrients they need to grow and strive. According to the World Health Organization, nearly half of deaths among children under 5 years of age are linked to undernutrition. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has released the 2024 Gatekeepers report entitled A Race to Nourish a Warming World, which emphasizes the devastating burden of malnutrition and explores innovations that can help tackle the crisis.
When most people hear the word malnutrition, they'll think of situations where there's a food shortage, an extreme food shortage, like a famine. And although that does happen and it's tragic, that's not the main case for malnutrition. Malnutrition's happening where some kid doesn't get the right diet, gets some diarrheal episode, and their gut, including the microbiome part of their gut, is inflamed, and so they're not able to take advantage of the food. And so with their African scientist, we looked at twins where one twin would do well and one wouldn't, and then, you know, took samples to understand, okay, exactly what's going on and how do you stop that? And so it's partly micronutrients that are missing, things like iron, zinc, vitamin A. It's partly a lack of protein. And so we have a variety of ways of intervening, some of which are very inexpensive. You know, of course, a critical period for nutrition, before you're born, your mother's nutrition affects your entire life, you know, how your brain and body develops. And so one of the exciting new interventions is giving pregnant mothers additional vitamins. You know, we've always traditionally given them two, iron and folic acid, but by adding four others, which is only a few dollars per pregnancy, we see that the health of the mother and the health of the baby are substantially improved.
Some of these interventions, as you mentioned, are being implemented right now. It's a big problem on a big scale. What else is needed?
The challenges, you know, whether it's malnutrition or malaria, they're not quite as visible to the entire world that should pitch in as it should be. And particularly right now, you know, where the world's very focused on, you know, got a war in Ukraine, we've got unrest in the Middle East. The focus on helping the continent where, you know, there's the most young people and the most growth and therefore the most potential, I'd say that's quite a bit down from where we were before the pandemic. And we see that not just in understanding the health issues, but, you know, helping out with the debts and the debt payments that many African countries have, or even the aid levels. You know, aid to Africa is the lowest portion of aid that it's been in history. You know, one topic people do pay attention to is climate change. And so, you know, there's an important connection in the report where we say, you know, if you feel bad about climate change, what should you do? Well, these nutritional interventions are the highest impact thing to help the adaptation to minimize the damage. And that area of climate adaptation doesn't get enough effort. And then given that resources are so limited, what are the things that should be done to help these children? You know, that's the human lens that we need to apply to, you know, if I care about climate change, what am I doing to help?
That was Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He was speaking with my colleague, Linor Mudu, from Seattle, Washington. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, democracy faces challenges in its birthplace. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. In an apparent assassination attempt on Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump over the weekend raised new questions Monday about political violence in the United States. Democrats and Republican leaders called for more resources for the U.S. Secret Service. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
President Joe Biden on Monday condemned what appeared to be a second assassination attempt against former President Donald Trump.
In America, we resolve our differences peacefully, the ballot box, not at the end of a gun.
The U.S. Secret Service had already come under congressional scrutiny for its handling of the July 13th assassination attempt on Trump. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson telling Fox News this second incident only increases the need for change.
I think there are some really patriotic, great people working in the Secret Service, but it's the leadership. We have no faith.
Trump told Fox News Digital on Monday the Democrats' rhetoric was to blame. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer condemned the apparent assassination attempt Monday.
There is no place in America for political violence of any kind.
The suspect, Ryan Ruth, is accused of hiding in the bushes with a rifle outside Trump's Florida golf course. The 58-year-old activist is a strong supporter of Ukraine in its fight against Russia. He spoke with Newsweek Romania in 2022 about the war.
This conflict is definitely black and white. This is about good versus evil.
Russia said Monday the assassination attempt was a warning to the United States. Dmitry Peskov is the spokesperson for the Kremlin.
Playing with fire has its consequences.
Law enforcement officials told reporters the layers of security added in the days after the first assassination attempt helped protect Trump on Sunday. Rick Bradshaw is the sheriff for Palm Beach County.
The system can work. Because the suspect didn't even get close to getting a round off, and we apprehended him, and brought him to justice.
Ruth appeared in a Florida federal court Monday morning to answer weapons charges. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Still in the United States, a small town in the Midwestern state of Ohio finds itself at the center of a controversy involving fake news about migrants eating residents' pet cats and dogs. VOA Creole traveled to Springfield and has this report narrated by Elizabeth Shaniff.
Haitian migrants living in Springfield, a small town in the Midwestern state of Ohio, are making headlines nationwide after being accused of eating residents' pets. The allegation, posted on social media and amplified by the Republican vice presidential nominee, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, was repeated in last week's debate by former President Donald Trump, sparking outrage. Haitian migrants in Ohio, like Cleo, deny the allegations.
I saw it on the internet. People talking about all Haitians are misbehaving. But definitely, there is no proof. Anyway, I don't walk around town.
Although local authorities confirmed there is no evidence of migrants eating pets, the rumor has prompted numerous bomb threats, forcing school closures, and is negatively affecting Haitians' lives in Springfield. Baptiste is a Haitian migrant here.
Since we are Haitian, when news like that is published in the media, it scares us. We are just searching for a better life.
Another Haitian migrant who spoke to VOA on the condition of anonymity for security reasons says an angry resident pulled a knife on him.
So, manage your telephone, man.
I got a phone call and I step outside with a friend. We are just standing and I saw a guy's truck. I wasn't even touching it. And he came out and asked, "What are you doing?" We said, "We are just standing and we are not leaning on your truck." The guy's truck, he posed like he was ready to fight. And his wife told us, "Just leave, go back inside." So we ignore him and left. But what really stunned me is the guy turn and say, "You Asians." Then he pulled a knife on me.
Brian Heck is the Springfield city manager.
Springfield is a dynamic community with many positive attributes. It is disappointing that some of the narrative surrounding our city has been skewed by misinformation circulating on social media and further amplified by political rhetoric in the current highly charged presidential election cycle.
The migrant issue is complicated. It goes beyond allegations of eating pets. There are more than 15,000 Haitian migrants living in Springfield, which has a total population of 60,000. Monte is a local resident who says the Haitian migrants are taking jobs from Americans.
Jobs are getting took up, man. You know, all these, you say our factory needs 50 people. That could be 50 Americans that don't have a job. Instead, the Haitians, they take exactly all those 50 spots, man. So that's 50 people that don't have a job.
Ernest is a customer service representative at Adasa Latin Market. He says over 70% of his customers are Haitian, and the influx of migrants has created some conflict with local residents.
This is a small town. People are narrow-minded in some areas. So I can see how they would feel that way. And it's also because people, like I said, like people don't know because of or the cultural differences how to behave in certain manner.
One migrant says he was threatened after moving to Springfield from Florida 3 months ago. Now he's thinking about packing up and leaving town. For VOA Creole in Springfield, Ohio, Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News.
Still in the United States, America's enemies are ramping up efforts to impact the outcome of the U.S. presidential election and down ballot races. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Sillen reports on the expanding array of sophisticated influence operations taking aim at U.S. voters.
In the U.S. presidential race, the push to win over voters is in full swing. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
We will save our economy. We will rescue our middle class.
And Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris.
It's time to turn the page.
But the competition, according to U.S. officials, has been joined by Russia. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland.
President Vladimir Putin's inner circle, including Sergei Kirinikov, directed Russian public relations companies to promote disinformation and state-sponsored narratives as part of a program to influence the 2024 U.S. presidential election.
Part of the scheme, according to the U.S. indictment, included mimicking dozens of news websites to influence how U.S. voters think about critical issues. The other part involved Russia state-backed media outlet RT, charged with funneling almost $10 million to a U.S.-based media company. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
To pay unwitting Americans millions of dollars to carry the Kremlin's message to influence the U.S. elections and undermine democracy.
Russia's denied the charges. This is Russophobia, said Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova, an attack on freedom of speech. U.S. officials dismissed such denials as laughable. An unclassified intelligence assessment issued earlier this month calls Russia the most active foreign influence threat to the upcoming election, aiming to boost the chances of former President Donald Trump. And then there's Iran.
We have observed increasingly aggressive Iranian activity during this election cycle. That includes recently reported activities by Iran to compromise former President Trump's campaign and to avoid an election outcome that it regards as against its interests.
U.S. intelligence officials say China has also been running a small-scale social media campaign aimed at hurting candidates thought to be hostile to Beijing. But whether U.S. deterrence is working is questionable. Syracuse University's Margaret Tolev.
I don't think so far this has really broken through as a top issue that most American voters are following, but it's really important for voters to understand what's going on and how they may be pawns.
Giving Americans lots to think about as they get ready to head to the polls. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
And that's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, September 17, 2024. We now leave you with Ateny Garang singing in his native Denka language. We've been listening to Atem Garang with the song Nyan Panda, singing in his native Jiang language. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Peter Heinle, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.